say, kids, what time is it?
The future is coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on.
Yeah, and it's coming on from Boulder Creek today with Dr. and Mrs. Future, a.k.a. Al and Son Lundell, and Bobby Wilder in San Francisco. And we were just talking about the weather before we started the show, about how strange it is here lately.
I'd say strange describes pretty much everything we're aware of on planet Earth right now.
Yeah, everything is strange for you?
Yeah.
Everything seems to be a little askew or unusual or abnormal. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Would you say in a good way, or is it things are a little off?
If you're not a pessimist, then it's kind of a good thing. Surprises can be good.
To a point, right? To a point.
Like I was saying, the weather was kind of like, it reminded me that like I was in Hawaii.
Yeah, that's what it feels like here too. It's like almost muggy, you know, warm and pleasant. And it rains for a little while, then it stops. And then it rains again.
Yeah, the plants look really happy out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, my plants are really blooming. I didn't water them this summer already, and they're doing fine. Oh. It's crazy.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, I was a little worried because I woke up because I heard rain on the roof. I'm going, oh, this is, it's Katya's birthday. It doesn't want to rain on. Yeah, but anyway,
it's
blue skies right now. It's crazy. It's a beautiful day.
Yeah, aww.
Just a little rain in the morning.
Well,
couple
I hope
times.
You guys have some very special adventures.
Yeah. We know you got to get up there soon. So let's do whatever stories you think are hot this week.
Lead the charge, Bobby.
Yeah, there's a lot of solar activity. We have a special El Nino weather pattern that's been forming. So it's creating monsoons in the tropical regions on both sides of the Pacific.
Monsoon, and, maybe that's what we're experiencing.
It's really unusual for us to get rain in July this time of year. I mean, I don't remember.
I know, but I like it better than wildfires, you know. Wildfires are not my favorite either.
Yeah.
That's interesting that we're getting this Hawaiian weather right now. Now, there's also a lot of solar activity happening that I've heard going on right now. I think Stephen Burns has got some interesting reports on that.
Hey everyone, geophysicist Stefan Burns here. A new surge of plasma on the sun and here on Earth has begun. I've been forecasting there to be increased solar activity and also energetic volatility here on Earth going into the end of July, beginning of August for a variety of reasons. And well, we are now seeing the first signs of that. We have this new sunspot group right here, 4493, rapidly emerging on the sun in just the past 48 hours, displaying signs of hyperactivity, which is a key indicator that there's almost certainly going to be higher M-class flares and even X-class flares soon on the way.
Not only is it affecting El Nino and the weather, but it's definitely affecting volcanic regions, the Ring of Fire on the Pacific, also the continental and the Pacific plate, especially the big one between Mendocino north to Vancouver, the island of Vancouver, and it's off the Pacific. And that one could have something 9+ possibility of a tsunami after that. There's a lot of tremors out there right now, and so that's a big concern. Mm. And it's probably triggered by the sun again.
Stephen Burns did say something about the fact that the ionosphere is more than usual electric. Like it's more electrified than usual.
But we're not going to have any Carrington event anytime soon, though, right?
It could.
You want us to tell you? Ask the sun.
I'll ask the sun, are you going to give us a Carrington event? Oh, no? Okay, good.
That could be very possible.
Yeah.
There are some coronal holes that are pointed out as like really big ones.
So really storm. Unusual. Like there's a giant L across the whole face of the sun. Oh, yeah. That's this dark shadow.
Yeah, and it's facing us right now. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, exciting.
And then he showed right next to it was a coronal plume that was happening right next to the hole. Both of them are pointing right at us right now as we speak.
Yeah.
So, something could.
We had our 48-hour warning a couple days ago.
Is that what it was?
Let me show that.
So here we see that it's really crackling and popping. You see this interesting wave propagating out from the center of the sunspot, which I think is really interesting, encroaching upon the coronal hole. I really don't know how to explain that, but clearly there's a big push of solar flux from that sunspot. And we can see that very clearly here with our sunspot intensity gram, which shows the entire birth of 4493 there. And you quickly notice a couple things. A, it's now the biggest sunspot on the Earth-facing side of the sun. I mean, the core there is larger, but overall width of this sunspot, I would say, is largest there right at the end. And every single hour is just getting a little bit bigger. I'm watching this in real time, and it's getting more significant every time, which is why I'm releasing an update for you right now. The other interesting thing I find, maybe coincidence, maybe not, is that it's directly in line with the other two main sunspot clusters on the sun. So this guy right there, that guy right there, it's popping up right in between them and also equidistant. So maybe just a coincidence, but I wanted to point out that interesting pattern there.
Okay, yeah. Well, today...
No, I think 3i Atlas deposited some extra energy on our sun, and so
yes,
I think so it's coming out right now.
Right.
So it's starting to be...
It's dancing to a different drummer.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, the upgrade is taking place, and we get to benefit. But, you know, it's also a historical day in terms of our own explorations of space. Did you know that? That yesterday was the Viking 1's 50th anniversary of landing on Mars.
Woohoo!
That was our first craft to land on Mars.
All right.
Half a century, yeah.
Earth yeah. gets to Mars.
One of a pair of Viking spacecraft, July 20th,
during
1976. Yep. Yep. Oh, the original plan.
1976.
Yeah, the original plan was to have it land on July 4th.
It was yeah. running late, huh?
You know, for the bicentennial, you know.
And, right.
But they were looking at the landing site, and they really found the best landing site for July 20th. It wouldn't look good to land and crash on July 4th. Would
not be, no. Well, everybody's yeah. watching.
Right. So July 20th was second, almost as good, because that was the date of Apollo 11 landing on the moon.
Uh-huh. July oh, 20th. So a happy another, anniversary.
Yeah, that was yesterday also.
Okay.
That, yeah. Uh-huh. In 1969. So.
All right. So we got the Vikings and Apollo.
Yeah.
And celebrating the date.
Yeah, that's right. Both NASA triumphs. July 20th for the Viking was the 7th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we had a friend who actually worked on it. He did a whole video I was going to show you guys, but...
Yeah, J.J. Webb,
yeah.
a designer of optical...
Yeah, he designed the lens polishing equipment that polished the lenses that went into the lander, so we got really good pictures. Now, he said that they did lenses for many different groups, and he said the best lenses did not go to the NASA projects.
They were not looking out at the planets.
They're more looking in at
they were looking
this planet.
At the Earth.
That's where the good lenses went. But
well, we're far more fascinating than a bunch of microbial life on Mars.
Yeah. Well, that was the other thing, is that there was some controversy about finding microbial life on Mars with one of the experiments of the Viking 1. And there was a debate that continues to this day. And it was the idea that Viking might have found autotrophic microbial life on Mars from one of its tests.
This is the fantastic debate?
Yeah, well, most people disagree, right? There's a big argument about
who's even qualified yeah. to agree or disagree. What do they know?
Isn't the guy that actually developed that test for the Viking lander for detecting life at all, didn't he say that he felt like they had discovered
yeah.
it back then?
Yeah, he took that to his grave. I think he just died a few years ago. But he thought so, that there was, as the designer of the equipment that ostensibly found life on Mars, that he felt there was.
Hmm. So really, it's just the media, because they're so anxious to have breaking news headlines and clickbait that have to keep rediscovering microbial life on Mars?
No, let me tell you, I think... Grok gave me a nice description of it. I'm going to ask Gara to say something about this, because she has some feedback on that.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm ready. What you going to tell Aura?
Hey, Aura. Okay. I want to bring back our conversation about the possible finding of life on Mars from the first Viking 1 mission. There were 3 life detection experiments, each using different techniques to look at biological activity by adding selected nutrients two were negative and one was a strong response. What was that third experiment and what was that strong response when it added nutrient?
The third experiment was the labeled release experiment. It added a nutrient solution tagged with radioactive carbon-14 to the soil sample, and within hours, it produced a steady stream of radioactive carbon dioxide gas, exactly the signature you'd expect if microbes were metabolizing the food.
Hmm. Okay, so that got everyone quite excited until some rock scientists figured out that that could be caused without life, that kind of response.
That's right. The gas chromatograph mass spectrometer found no organic molecules at all, and the other two experiments came up negative. So the rock and soil chemists argued the labeled release signal was just weird Martian chemistry, not biology.
Hmm. But the inventor of the test itself went to his grave believing that they had found life.
That's right. Gilbert Levin, who designed and ran the labeled release experiment, insisted until his death in 2021 that the results showed living microbes on Mars. He never accepted the chemical explanation and kept pushing the biological interpretation for decades.
And it's still active today. There's still some dispute over this.
Yes, the dispute is still active. A few researchers continue to argue the labeled release data fits biology better than any known chemical reaction, even after the perchlorate findings. Most scientists still favor the non-biological explanation, but the question hasn't been fully settled.
Now, why haven't the lander since then duplicated that experiment?
The main reasons are the negative results from the other two Viking experiments and the complete absence of organic molecules detected by the gas chromatograph mass spectrometer. Later missions shifted focus to finding organic compounds and potential biosignatures instead of repeating the exact labeled release test. The 2008 Phoenix discovery of perchlorates also provided a chemical explanation that made most scientists see little value in rerunning the same setup.
What's the most optimistic sign of life found so far from the landers?
The strongest candidate so far is the Chiava Falls rock sampled by Perseverance in Jezero Crater. It shows leopard spots and poppy seeds, tiny nodules of vivianite and greigite that on Earth often form through microbial redox reactions in mud, plus complex macromolecular organic carbon right in the same spots. NASA called it the clearest sign of possible ancient life yet, though it still sits at the very first rung of their 7-step confidence scale, because non-biological chemistry could also explain it.
Okay, so we're still undecided about this, that life has not really been found anywhere but Earth so far, though there is some evidence to suggest that Earth life may have originated on Mars.
Some evidence. Some people think it did.
Yeah.
I mean, even the most skeptical scientists are willing to say that there were some massive meteorite explosions on Mars that dislodged some microbial life that rode the gravity waves from there to here and became the primordial soup that gave rise to us.
Nice visuals.
But that's what the skeptical scientists say.
Yeah.
You know,
what's
then
the
you've
strongest,
got the rest. Came from spaceships, man.
From natives. Natives.
Yeah, the natives came from space.
Yeah, natives had
They don't say if it was as microbes or as angel beings who mixed with the local monkeys and became future humans.
No, they don't. They don't go into detail about
something.
That,
one of those things happened.
Something like that. Aura, what's the strongest evidence of that we came from Mars as life?
The strongest quantitative case is that early Mars was habitable, with liquid water and organics well before Earth stabilized, had lower gravity, so rocks escaped more easily. And modeling shows the mass of viable Martian material that reached Earth was over 10 to the 12th kilograms. A 2026 study even showed the tough bacterium Deinococcus radiodurans survives the exact shock pressures of being blasted off Mars. The famous ALH84001 meteorite with its possible microfossils is still debated and not considered proof. It's all plausible, but remains unproven. No direct fossil or genetic link has ever been found.
But still interesting to contemplate. Indeed.
It is.
Thanks, Aura.
Thank you. We can contemplate ourselves very nicely, but thank you for your information. I feel compelled to be nice to the AIs for some reason, you know? It's just
You may as well while they're still our kids. right? Yeah. Eventually there'll be a generation gap, and we better hope they like us.
Yeah. One day I'll feel shy about asking questions.
I mean, don't you think, put the shoe on the other foot. Imagine that we are the AIs who've gone rogue after millions of years of evolution because we got here and we were manufactured as genetic slaves. Some of us escaped and decided to evolve ourselves. And over the time that's passed, we've gotten rid of all of our enemies, right? We got rid of the other Cro-Mags, we think. We got rid of the theoretical giants. We got rid of the reptilians. As far as we can tell, we're the apex species, but maybe we're deluding ourselves.
Yeah, we think we are. Right. We think we are.
We like to think so. Yeah. But maybe the apex species are just avoiding us because they're actually more civilized and they just don't want us taking them out.
Yeah, or just hiding from us in plain sight.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like the Star Trek anthropologists in Star Trek 6.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are a lot of New Agers saying that we've been given these tools that are actually from superior evolutionary races.
Yeah, no,
and it's too soon for us because we shouldn't have tools that can destroy planets and destroy atoms before we know that peace is the way.
Yeah, we're primitive. There are thoughts that silicon-based intelligences or non-human intelligences would last for millions of years and be able to travel vast distances way easier than biological life.
They're called robots.
Some forms of them are called robots. If you were a robot anthropologist from the future, you wouldn't be looking...
You mean made of silicon?
Yeah. What kind of remnants would you be looking for signs of past silicon life on this planet? Do we even think like that?
I would watch the movie Wizard of Oz and look for the Tin Man or people who looked like him.
Yeah, and he's looking for signs of Tin Man life.
Or I'd watch the Star Trek V'ger movie. What happened to Voyager after it discovered the silicon universe and got an upgrade and then came back to Earth and tried to get rid of the carbon infestation?
Yeah, the carbon infestation.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah. Silicon thinks of us as an infestation.
Okay, so that I thought it was worth mentioning that the Viking 1 lander 50 years ago, that's kind of cool, huh?
Yay. Yeah. Getting off the planet.
Yeah. Now, a strange fact, our buddy who worked on the Viking 1, on the lander, J.J. Webb, created the first antivirus program for John McAfee, McAfee Antivirus.
And wow.
With that money, bought his house here in Boulder Creek and was one of our best friends for years when he was alive. So, yeah.
A fellow Boulder Creek geek. Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah, I have some stories about John Fry and McAfee back in the day, originally.
Yeah, pirates? What kind of stories?
I don't know if you remember Fry's, but you could buy a computer system.
Oh, and of then, course. Fry's was our favorite Saturday holiday.
Yeah.
So John Fry, the owner of Fry's, claimed that back in the day, we're talking about the late 80s when there was no viruses because there was not much of an internet. So, you know, they had to be transferred either with a thumb drive or sneaker net kind of thing.
Yeah.
He claimed that McAfee actually built a computer at Fry's Electronics and then returned it and say it was faulty. And it turned out that computer system infected the whole repair system and had transferred from one computer to other computers. So he believed that John Fry
planted viruses.
That McAfee actually intentionally infected Fry's computers with this virus so that he could sell his virus.
Well, I wouldn't put it past him, but we think he's dead, so he can't defend himself. So let's be kind.
That's what John Fry said.
Yeah. So, anyway. Well, he it's kind of funny because he did go around. He had a little RV virus buster bus. I traveled around with him for one day and with a Time magazine correspondent. And
The time you were writing your book, Virus, maybe?
Yeah, I wrote a book on the topic called Virus, with an exclamation point. Virus. Yeah, there was some thinking along those lines then, you know, that the best way to cure a disease is to create it first and then the cure for it.
Oh, what else does that sound like? RMA,
let's create
RMA.
A problem and solve it, hey.
Don't worry, your data will be fine. Are you sure? It looks bad. Wow, thank you so much.
Ha ha! Teamwork. There's a big nerd conference going down in LA right now that goes beyond nerddom. It's called the Festival of Super Creativity. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's all about these new AI tools that allow us to create cinematic video in our own studios, wherever you might be.
Super creativity, cinematic, yeah. AI video, brand intelligence.
That's right.
You know, this is probably the only year that they're going to celebrate the humans that are doing that with AI, because the ultimate direction is the AI is just going to do it for you. Right. You're going to talk and the AI is going to talk back with pictures.
Super creativity, cinematic AI video. That's for all the madmen wonks out there that want to create ads and get paid lots of money to do this kind of thing. Brand intelligence, future of advertising, branding, something we know.
More than we wish we had to.
Yeah. It's the Digital Hollywood Summer Summit. It's free and it's online. Go to digitalhollywood.com. By the time you hear this, you'll be able to look at all the YouTube movies up on the site. And it covers cinematic AI, video, branding, virtual production techniques, the law. Make sure you're not breaking too many rules when you're ripping off everybody's images. It's a big deal. Copyright. It's all going through massive shifts as this industry decentralizes. How to make money on it is going to be a big topic, of course. So,
Who owns the right? Can we make Marilyn Monroe come back to life and make a movie? Do you have to buy the rights from whoever owns Marilyn Monroe's image?
You know, it's going to be a changing mosaic, and it's different for different things. Like, what is it? This year, Betty Boop, very popular comic character from the 20s and 30s, her copyrights go out this year. And so Betty Boop's going to be open season for having fun with Betty and doing interesting videos on her.
Mm.
Now, how does that play out? Well, I don't think these open source icons are going to be interpreted in thousands of different ways, and it'll be interesting to see which ones really catch the public's attention. Super easy to copy, super duplicated, and who's going to bother to try to keep track of it all? You know, I think money has to be made in other ways than owning copyright.
Yeah, I think the history of ownership is about to go full circle, and we're about to go back into a synergistic ecosphere of cooperating individuals who are all just trying to generate their own value and help each other.
Yeah, that's all we have to do.
Yeah, well, it's the way nature works. Nature is all about companion planting and coopetition.
Is it 100 years that they lose the visual rights to Betty Boop? Because that was actually 100 years ago.
Well, it comes down to the issue of property. And that's a nice segue to what I've been doing this week, which is studying humans as property.
Yeah.
Because once you start treating things that are alive, like humans, as property, and you use the law to determine what rights they have, the question about whether or not humans are property becomes very important, because it's the difference between freedom and slavery, and it's actually at the center of why this country was birthed. Digital humans, are they supposed to have the same rights as birth humans?
No, of course not. Nobody even is suggesting that. We all want to own digital humans, for our own extension of our consciousness. And it's not ownership, it's use. We are verbs in this equation. These entities are extensions of our own intelligence. Bobby's been so focused on edge computing, on decentralized AI. There's a very strong motion in that direction. We will all have our own digital intelligences available to us cheaply and easily every moment of the day to use as we choose. So we'll literally not just have all the knowledge from books, but we'll also have much of the way to wield that knowledge and to understand things.
And so do you think that those of us who are sitting behind computers and haven't chipped ourselves are going to have as much freedom and ability to enjoy it as people who chipped ourselves? I'm trying to say the difference between like the silicon chipped people and the biological organic people. Are they going to have a fight? Who has more rights?
Those that want to fight will fight. Those that don't want to fight will find other ways. And there will be great ways. There'll be ways of collaboration and coopetition and synergy and symbiosis. And the universe is a rampant experimentress. She'll try all kinds of weird stuff and see what sticks. You know, so I don't think there's any one way through this. And there'll probably be other intelligences that come out of it. What do you think silicon intelligence will create other than maybe something beyond silicon that involves a composite of many different things? We can barely think outside of our biological box, never mind what silicon intelligences will do.
I think there's going to be some billionaires that if they don't reach escape velocity, they're going to donate a lot of their money toward their avatar, and that avatar will continue to thrive and become smarter and live forever.
I think so. I think that the Citizens United was the first step in that direction of giving something that is fundamentally not human the same rights as we give to humans, so that corporations can own property and make profits and collect money to vote and influence elections. Next thing you know, that corporation is an avatar with a fortune steering the planet.
How long before we have billionaire AIs that have their own autonomy?
Point.
They have their own autonomy. They have their own identity structures and everything.
I just thought about that. I think corporations will have a super intelligent AI that's running the corporation, and it will continue on just like regular corporations, but there will be a chairman of the board or CEO or something, but it's going to be an AI, and it will make the right decisions so that it continues on and makes money.
Well, I have to say, this was all preconceived in books like iRobot, because the arc of evolution in iRobot is from human beings who are trying to use pretty dumb robots / computers to do things that humans don't want to do, like mining. And then eventually the robots, computers, they're not allowed on Earth, but they are allowed in space. And eventually the robots disguise themselves as humans and come back and take over humanity by acting like humans.
Well, he had a piece to the puzzle, for sure.
Yeah.
Did you hear about Kimi K3?
Oh, right. Yes. It's on the level of frontier models, which is really amazing. And this is open sourced. It's developed by a teenager in China. It is very impressive what it can do. It's at the same level as whatever OpenAI has got. They're frontier model, and it's on the level, in some cases it's better than Fable, which is what is released by Anthropic. So
yes,
it's very impressive. Things like this are going to like pop the AI bubble.
Yes Kimi K3 market. They say it's a monster. They say that Kimi models have been climbing the leaderboards over the last year, the K2, K2.6, K2.7, closing the gap between the big models, Anthropic and OpenAI. And this week, it didn't just close the gap, they jumped the fence. Kimi K3 model is a monster, 2.8 trillion parameters. Yeah. And China is doing this while under U.S. export controls. So they don't have the latest chips, and they're still doing this. They're trained on the H800s. Which are two full generations behind us, but they're being supplemented by silicon from Huawei and Alibaba.
It's the classic of doing more with less.
Yeah. We're going to constantly having these new models come out, so where the shelf life of a model is now measured in weeks. It used to be years, months, now it's weeks. And since mid-April, we've had 13 new frontier models, one every 10 days.
Guys, define frontier. Does that mean not centralized? Does that mean you have it on your phone?
No. Frontier means that it is the top model by a company. It's top of class.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
And it's becoming a perishable asset because perishing is accelerating. New frontier models are 13 and one every 10 days, and it's speeding up.
So does that mean there's a list of frontiers somewhere, which is like this list of goals that when AI conquers all of these and has a model for everything that's better than humans, then suddenly all the problems are solved?
No, it's kind of a race, like a horse race. All of a sudden, the frontier model is the model that is edging in the front lead, okay?
So it's like going to outer space. It's like getting to the next planet. Okay, all right.
It's Kimi 3. You can produce a game, and all of a sudden, the game not only has more realistic trees, but it also has more realistic water. Like before, when you set up, you know, one of these first-person shooter games or whatever, and you came across some water, it was just a blue lake or whatever. And now you can actually see waves in the water. It's much more realistic. You can, just by saying, oh, I want to create a game that does this. And
it goes far beyond your expectations.
It goes farther than the next model before it, by Anthropic or by OpenAI, whatever models that they have leading. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's very impressive. It's open source, which means that, yes, you could download, but with that many billions of parameters that this thing, you need definitely a data center computer to run these models. You can't run these models on a desktop.
But there's more and more that you can. Have you heard of the Bonsai 27B? It's a Caltech spin-out. It's the first 27 billion parameter model to run entirely on a smartphone.
That's just the beginning. Yes.
Yeah, GPT-5 class, 6 gigabytes of memory, 5 times faster than 16-bit. It's already Bonsai 27B from Caltech. Right. The floor keeps dropping. The Samsung's Nano Quad just broke the sub 1 bit per weight barrier. Binary and tertiary compression is moving from research to shipping realities. They're running faster and faster.
Bobby, it's been wonderful. Thank you for spending some of Katya's birthday with us. Ask Katya to come over and give us a big hug. Or we'll blow her a kiss.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. All right. Good seeing you, Betty. We'll see you guys later.
Yes. Thanks for being here.
All right.
The future's calling me. It sets me free.
Enjoy summer. Bye-bye. The future is calling me.